Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. I would like to make a little reminder for those that are joining us live. Make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page where you can join the chat room. If there's a question, comment, point of order, something you'd like for us to address our guests today, that's a great place to flow it in. Both Eagle One and myself will be monitoring the chat room there, and we will try to bring those good points in as soon as we can. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some previous shows, or if you have to leave us halfway through and you want to catch the rest of the goodness, you can always get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can cheat and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. Also, occasionally, and it probably happened today, we'll go a little bit over the hour. If you're with us live, of course, it will click off after the 60 minutes, but it does keep recordings a little bit of an after show, so to speak, because we like to make sure that our guests are able to complete their line of questions. And with a panel format like today, we want to make sure that all of our guests have a chance to contribute to a question. In that case, just come back in, grab the archive, zip up to the 60-minute mark, and you can catch the rest of the conversation that goes on past an hour. Now let's get on with the show. Real excited about a kind of a different format. We do panels now and then, and we've got one set up for you today to bring some stuff on board that I think folds into a lot of issues and conversations that we've covered both at our blogs over at USNI blog and just in general conversation. And that has to do with two things. One is the bringing in the voice and the point of view of our junior officers into the conversation, but also the naval service, whether you go back to Perry and his black ships, but it's pretty much always been true, that of all the services, when it comes to understanding the world at which we pursue our national interests in, the naval officer has a very unique place. We're always forward deployed in peace and at war, and it's something that you need to have that depth and that international knowledge well before you need it for hard reasons. And one of the ways that we do that is through the Olmsted Scholars Program, and it helps us develop a core cadre of military officers that help see the world and the people in it a little different than usual. And we have a panel of former serving and just starting Olmsted Scholars that we're going to talk about that and maybe a few other items, especially because most of these have been focused, and actually all of the members of our panel have been focused on the Pacific and Indian Ocean areas. And our panel guest today will be Lieutenant Joshua Christensen, U.S. Navy, Olmsted Class of 2009, spent his time in Beijing, China. Lieutenant Matthew D. Myers, United States Navy, also class of 2009 in New Delhi, India. We also had Lieutenant Olivia Dagenkolb, the U.S. Navy, Olmsted class of 2013 in Hanoi, Vietnam. And also Captain Gary Sampson, United States Marine Corps. He's a class of 2009 in a place in Taiwan I won't even try to pronounce. I'll let him do that. So, Liv, J.D., Matt, and Gary, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks, Sal. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, and the way our format's going to go for our listeners is we're going to bounce our questions along. I really want to give a special thanks. I'll make him blush if I can. JD really did the yeoman's work in putting our panel together. So JD, from Host and Coast, you thanks a lot for bringing Matt, Gary, and Liv to join us this afternoon. And I'm going to give you a chance, too. I'll throw the first question at you, and I guess we'll let you do this, and once it's done, nobody else will have to do it. But a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with the Olmstead program, so I thought I'd give you a chance to outline that to start. And then I'm really interested in hearing from all four of y'all. You know, you've got your commission, you're a second lieutenant, you're an ensign, you're a JG, you're working your way up. Where in that course did you become aware of the Olmstead program, and then what motivated you to pursue it where you are right now? And JD, why don't you kick it off, and then we'll go Matt, Gary, and Liv.
Thanks, Al. Good to be here this evening. I guess the first thing I would do is I would point your leaders to the, or your listeners to the website, the George and Carol Olmstead Foundation, and that can be found at olmstedfoundation.org. Olmstead is O-L-M-S-T-E-D, and they lay it out pretty clearly there. The Olmstead Foundation is a registered 501c3 nonprofit foundation. The express goal is to provide military leaders the opportunity to achieve fluency in a foreign language, pursue graduate studies overseas, and achieve an in-depth understanding of foreign cultures. The idea is it's designed for the warfighter. Most of our experience and knowledge as it relates to our partners, potential adversaries, and any international actor is focused on the intelligence and the foreign area officer side. This is designed for the line officer. And typically, you get 2 years in country plus a year of language training. One of the real strengths of the program is the length of time we were able to dedicate to our to engage with our target country. So it's been going on for over 50 years. We've had over 500 scholars. The Navy's had their share there with 138 Navy scholars over the years. Some names your listeners might recognize. Admiral Trost was a former CNO. We have a couple current serving three-star admirals. There's Admiral Tidd is the J3 right now. I'm sorry, Vice Admiral Tidd, and then Vice Admiral Weisskopf is our Navy Inspector General. There's a couple key names from the Navy side. But perhaps the best example has been General John Abizade, former CENTCOM commander at the start of the war. He was he's director of the Olmstead Foundation now, but he's Olmstead class in 1978. He's Lebanese by descent, but didn't speak any Arabic. And then he was able to go in 1978 to Jordan, learn Arabic, follow on studies. The program was administered a little differently then, but he went to Harvard, studied Arabic and Middle Eastern affairs. And so then, you know, when he did proceed, he progressed to the four-star general level, he'd already had that years of engaging with the region really set him up well to make significant decisions as the leader of that campaign. So that's kind of the idea behind the foundation and what they're doing for national security at large.
And the second part of the question?
Remind me, the second part of the question is that why I decided?
Yeah. At what point did you become aware of the Olmstead program, decide, hey, that's something I want to pursue, and you know how you got kicked off from there?
Right. So I'm a surface warfare officer. And we typically do our first couple tours as payback for our commissioning time, and then we have that window in which we were able to pursue graduate education. And I set my targets on the program quite early on. I knew I wanted to go to China. Beijing was my number one request for anywhere in the non-English speaking world, and I was extremely excited to get that. So I don't know if it was prescient or just lucky. You could kind of see the writing on the wall, the pivot to Asia, the increased emphasis on China. And so it was important to me to be able to, well, I guess the real strength of the program is being able to engage with the culture in a way that you can't get anywhere else. I mean, even if you go to NPS and do a national security studies program, you're not going to be able to meet local people on the street, engage with the culture, develop not only the cultural fluency, but the linguistic and cultural fluency together really appealed to me. And so I felt very honored to be selected as part of the 2009 class.
Matt?
Well, I, like JD, found out about the Olmstead program as a real fresh ensign. I had requested and was assigned a sea duty out of Japan for my first assignment with Strike Fighter Squadron 195 in Atsugi. This is a plug for good old-fashioned marketing. I was at the Navy Education Office signing up for Japanese lessons when I saw the Olmstead Foundation's flyer sitting on a rack. Picked it up and thought, this is just for me. So I started talking to senior officers early on. I'm with the Intelligence Division officer with 195, so I spoke with the Strike Group N2 about Olmstead. He was very encouraging. told me, get another tour under your belt and then apply. I was fortunate enough on my second tour in Korea to meet Admiral Weizkup, who was then CNFK. In fact, that was through a funny coincidence. Olmsted scholar, I think class of 2007, had my same name. He was Lieutenant Matt Myers, and we were waiting for our in-brief with the Admiral. His yeoman called out Lieutenant Matt Myers. We both stood up. So this led to conversations about the Olmsted program, and a year later, as I was nearing the end of my tour in Korea, Admiral Weizkup wrote me a letter of recommendation and was fortunate enough to be picked up for the class of 09 to India, a country that was not even on my initial list. So, JD, I think you saw what happens when you set your sights on a country, you get exactly what you want. I found the serendipity, a word which comes from a fake piece of Indian literature, long story that only an English major would get. Anyway, through a piece of serendipity, I had a fantastic experience in a country that until I was selected, I didn't even know what language I would be learning.
Wow.
Yeah, beautiful. Sometimes you're going to go here anyway does turn out best. Gary.
Well, Sal, thanks for having me on here. The token Marine Corps officer. We're all naval officers, so it's all good. But I do appreciate being here, and thanks to JD as well for thinking of me when he's putting together this panel for you. For me, I didn't hear about the program as early as the other two gentlemen who spoke already. I didn't learn about it until 2007. I was a first lieutenant at the time, and I was working up at U.S. Marine Corps Forces Pacific headquarters in Camp Smith. And I just saw the Marine Administrative or Admin message that came out that are posted online about the program. I had been interested in learning language and cultural programs. That was something that I wanted to pursue anyhow. I'd never heard of this program. I knew about the FAO program in the Marine Corps, but I saw this and I said, hey, this sounds like it's an even better deal than the FAO program, and you know, I'll apply for this, and if it doesn't work out, then I'll just, you know, apply for the FAO program in the spring or whatever. But you know, luckily it worked out. I had put in a variety of universities in Japan that I wanted to go to. I studied Japanese a little bit during my undergrad years at the University of Nebraska. And funny story, actually, JD and I were there at the same time. We graduated in 2004 from UNL. So it's a very small world, and put us back together, and we both got selected for the Olmsted program. And we were classmates there at DLI for about a year learning Chinese. So very small world there. But I've been really set on going to Japan, but lo and behold, that year the foundation had selected already two Marines to go to Japan and study there. So they said, hey, you need to kind of open your aperture a little bit here with in terms of your selections. Where else do you want to go? Give us some more countries to look at, and maybe we can place you in the program. And so I know I wanted to focus on East Asia and the Pacific, so I listed China and South Korea on down, and Taiwan was the end of my list. But when I found out I was going to Kaohsiung, Taiwan, I was very pleased with that. I had never heard of the place before I found out I was going there. I'd heard of Taipei, obviously, I knew where Taiwan was at, but the city, Kaohsiung, is actually the second largest city in Taiwan. It's down in the southern part of Taiwan, and a little bit off the beaten path, but I really enjoyed my time on the program. And one other thing I'd like to comment on real quick about in terms of like institutional knowledge about the Olmsted Scholar Program is I found, and probably other scholars have as well, that there's really quite a variance in the institutional knowledge about the program. I'd say in the Marine Corps, it's not a well-known program at all. I'd say probably the Air Force has the most kind of resident knowledge about the program, and they promote it the best to their junior officers. I'm actually stationed on the Air Force base right now out in Denver, Colorado, and I see how they kind of market and promote it to their institution, inside their service, and I'm kind of envious of that. I know the Marine Corps doesn't do that, and I think the Navy's probably a little bit better about it than the Marine Corps. I think we've got some things to learn in terms of how we promote programs like the Olmsted Scholar Program in the Marine Corps. But so that's kind of how I came to the program and how I ended up going to Kaohsiung, Taiwan.
Liv.
Morning, sir. It's a pleasure to be on. I guess evening in your time of the world. It is.
Yes, ma'am.
Pleasure to be here with you today. So I found out about the Olmsted Scholarship while I was stationed at a ROTC unit as part of the Seaman to Admiral program. It was very, very early on. A friend of mine, you know, had mentioned it to me, and I went on board the OlmstedFoundation.org site that JD had mentioned earlier and kind of surfed around a little bit and realized that it was just a fantastic opportunity and program and was extremely interested in it. Again, as JD mentioned, because it was designed for the unrestricted line officer, you know, the intent was not to switch to Intel or DeFeo. The intent was to stay in your community. And as a naval flight officer, I enjoy what I do and felt that this would be a unique, fantastic opportunity to, you know, kind of learn about another culture, to broaden my aperture within the Navy, and then have the opportunity to come back to my community, hopefully. And as far as choosing Vietnam goes, as Gary mentioned, you know, during the application process, you list 10 locations and your order of preference from 1 to 10. And Vietnam was about halfway down my list. I'd taken Mandarin in college and had hoped to go to either China or Taiwan just because that was my background. But I'm extremely excited about going to Vietnam now. It's more of a niche experience. It's something that it's a community in a country that we're just starting to interact with and engage with more frequently, and I think that Vietnam's just starting to open up to the world, and I'm extremely fascinated about going and looking forward to the experience there.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people, not that have done Olmsted in Vietnam, but who have gone to Vietnam and come back. I think you're going to have a great experience there. Eagle One.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, I had a great question all set to go, but then Sal said he wanted to ask the question, so I'm going to give you something else, which Matt, you started out, I think, saying you thought this was a program for warfighters as opposed to some other programs. Could you kind of go into what you mean by that, and then we'll kind of move along with the others and see what they think about it?
Well, I think it was JD who said that. I would actually take the other tack entirely. I'll be the contrarian here. I'm an intelligence officer, probably the only restricted line officer in this panel, and by my count, I was only the second intelligence officer to get picked up for this in the Navy. I see this as a natural fit for my community. People do think of intelligence officers as being specialists in other, you know, in foreign countries, cultures, languages, and so forth, but it's not something we receive any formal training in. I looked back from the time I was in my entry-level training to the biographies of a couple of the intelligence community's leading lights. That's Admiral Edwin Layton, Captain Joseph Rochefort. This was Nimitz's intelligence officer and his head cryptologist, the men who broke the Japanese codes and who spearheaded our intelligence effort at Midway. Both of them were Japanese language students in the late 1920s, early 1930s. A program that I saw as in many ways kind of an analog to the Olmsted program a generation earlier. These were men who took, again, that experience of being totally immersed in a culture, of learning the language, and applied it at a critical time in our history to understanding, in that case, the enemy, the way that General Olmsted in World War II would use his understanding gained from living in China to helping to achieve a peace there. At any rate, to come back to where we started, I certainly recognize the value of having warfighters well-versed in foreign cultures, but I think for an intelligence officer, it's equally critical. I have returned to my field, my designator. I'm serving with a PAC Fleet N2 right now. I wouldn't say that my Olmsted time the understanding of India per se is directly applicable to what I do in the N2, but the broadening of my intellectual horizons that happened while I was there has affected me to the core, and I certainly feel I'm a better officer, a better person for it.
JD, how about you?
Well, to follow up a little bit on what Gary was saying, institutionally, I think the services vary both in terms of the reputation that the program enjoys within the service as well as their ability to capitalize on the investment in their officers. So coming off of my Olmsted assignment in Beijing, I was assigned to a ship on the east coast of the United States. So maybe that was expecting a little too much of Millington to put me in San Diego or Japan or Hawaii. But I do expect that down the line, opportunities will that perhaps we can't even see coming now will be revealed as a result of the Olmsted scholarship. And I do like the fact that you generate a lot of experience and expertise within the country, but with the goal of being educated broadly, not with the goal necessarily of being an expert on the staff, but with the goal of understanding the culture and the region that you're engaging with to make significant decisions down the line. So that to me was one aspect of the program that really appealed to me, was the fact that the focus was on broad education with the idea of contributing to national defense in the future.
Liv, how do you see this fitting into your future?
Well, I think that, you know, the broad perspective that you get of another culture, and honestly seeing how they view us is extremely helpful, especially in contingency situations. And I think we've seen that in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, we're not dealing with a standard war out there. You've got counterinsurgency operations, and with the military and political aspects of war being so closely tied together, I can't imagine that General Abizaid's experience wasn't, you know, acutely important to his ability to execute, I would say, a successful campaign, or, you know, to make the best of, I don't want to say the opportunity provided, but, you know, his position as a general in the war. I don't know if that makes any sense. I hope so.
Makes sense.
Five in the morning, and I'm still waking up.
Oh, come on. An NFL like you, you should be fine. Nothing possible. It's funny, and I guess I'll throw this to Gary to give out the first response. And I think that Matt's response might be a little different, but kind of an undercurrent that I've heard in a couple of your answers folded into the second question I wanted to ask. I had a feeling since I was an ensign and all the way through 05, it just got a greater feeling with me. And one thing I think is so great about this program is I had the pleasure of working with foreign officers, mostly Commonwealth, but also some Germans who were doing their foreign exchange tour here with the U.S. And I've had the pleasure of living overseas for quite a few years as well. And the importance in the military of us having a broader sense, because unlike Europeans or Asians, you know, we're a continent-sized country. We don't somebody could spend their whole life in the U.S. and not interact with somebody who speaks a different language, and it's not their fault, just the nature of our size and our country. But what I found, as my enthusiasm for having officers spend some time serving overseas, whether as exchange officers or studying or something like that, just to soak in the rest of the world, is there's a lot of not just institutional ignorance, but also a little bit of institutional opposition. I remember when raising this issue as my career progressed, I would get classic answers. And I think, J.D., you mentioned issues with Millington. I've always called it the Millington diktat, where, wait, you can't go 2 years with a non-competitive fit rep. No, you need to go here and do this. You know, here you are, a JG or a lieutenant, and somebody's trying to make a Commodore out of you. It's like, no, you know, I'm really not worried about that right now. And so a lot of people can be scared off or making an offer they can't refuse to not pursue something like that. But then something else a couple of y'all mentioned comes along. You reach the right general officer or flag officer who you have a brief conversation with, and they go, oh, you should have gone that direction. This is a great program. Everybody will take care of you. And it almost seems happenstance or chance, depending upon where you run into the cycle of the right people at Millington, or who's your first flag officer in chain of command situation. And starting off with Gary for the Marine Corps that I'm not that familiar with, how do you feel that your community and your institutional support is going to be to make sure that what is, at least in my opinion, an extremely value-added career to the Marine Corps or the Navy in a macro sense, whether they're going to make sure from at least a career perspective that it's going to be worst-case scenario, a break-even for you, but you're not going to be get caught in what we call in the Navy the Millington diktat, where you get punished for doing a good thing. Matt? Excuse me, Gary.
Okay, yeah, no problem. I think that a lot of people kind of categorize the Olmstead program, they look at it kind of the same as the FAO program in the Marine Corps. And the Marine Corps, which is different from the Navy, we understand, the FAO program is actually kind of a dual-track thing where you do an assignment as a FAO, and you go back to your primary MOS and do an assignment there, and you switch back and forth, unlike what I understand for the Navy is, where if you decide to become a FAO, that's all you're going to be doing for the rest of your career. So you kind of have to make that choice. In the Marine Corps, you don't have to. And actually, I would say, you know, with our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan and overseas here in the past 10 years or so since 9/11, I think it's become very common knowledge across the Department of Defense and all the services that having this cultural and regional and area and language knowledge kind of all tied together, this is a value-added thing that they're looking for more people to do this, not less. And it's something that, you know, is going to be sought after going forward by your service. And I think that is the perception in the Marine Corps right now with programs like this. And something J.D. mentioned and that I think I will probably benefit from as well is the whole U.S. government pivot to Asia or however it's being termed these days. But it's very good timing for someone like J.D. or myself or even Matt or Liv. We're all kind of focused on Indian Ocean or, you know, Pacific Ocean, East Asia, Southeast Asia, just that whole area. So I think it's something that can be very beneficial to all of our careers going forward. And obviously there's a lot of things to go into that besides just saying, hey, you know, you get some great knowledge and whatever, you know, you got to get the right kind of assignments. And sometimes it helps if you know people to make sure you're getting those assignments. But for me, I really think that's going to benefit me. And really some of the things that Matt said about the benefits that he sees is coming from the program for him as an intel officer. I actually am an intel officer in the Marine Corps as well. And I think that this really, having this foreign country knowledge, the cultural knowledge, the language skills that go with it, can only help in what I do for the Marine Corps as an intelligence officer. And coming out of the program, I went straight into a billet, my primary MOS, where I'm a commanding officer of a company in the Marine Cryptologic Support Battalion out here in Denver, Colorado, and you know, it's directly related to my MOS. It's command assignment. So these are the things that kind of the Olmstead program is looking for. They want people to go back to their regular MOS and get these assignments of greater responsibility. And if you're doing that, then that's kind of what the foundation is looking for. They don't want guys who kind of just go fail and don't apply these things they learn on the program to their primary MOS, which, you know, in many cases is like JD has said and others have said, is, you know, warfighting type focus. I'm not an infantry officer. I'm not a pilot. Those are kind of, I think, those are the folks who mainly get selected in the Marine Corps for the program. But, you know, there is value having other MOSs picked for as well. Like, for instance, for me as an intel officer, I think it will be beneficial. So I hope that kind of answers your question in terms of the Marine Corps and how the program is viewed.
It absolutely does, and it sounds like the Marine Corps is getting the rhythm right. And you're spot on, all four of you. I think serendipity in play. Boy, what a great time to get some really fresh and soaked in knowledge of these four nations. Liv, over to you.
I am a little bit concerned about how this is going to affect my ability to stay in my primary NEC as a naval flight officer. To mitigate that, I'm kind of looking at hoping to get some sort of challenging, arduous at-sea tour, maybe a shooter tour, something like that, after this tour, the 3 years of Olmstead. I think that, especially in, you know, I have a pretty limited exposure to other services, but within naval aviation, the traditional, the golden career path, as it were, is to pretty much stay aviation-centric, possibly with the exception of a joint tour between your department head tour and your command tour until you are post-command, so at the commander level. And at that point, you know, you're expected to branch out and to be able to play the joint game and to, you know, understand all the other services and to have great perspective on the world and to, you know, really make fantastic decisions. And I think that being able to take these 3 years as a junior officer to kind of get the cultural perspective, to, you know, see things a little more globally, to understand how, like I mentioned earlier, other people view us, I think is, you know, really just extremely important and key to our military success is we reach out further in the global world and we, you know, rebalance to Asia and wherever else we go in the future. You know, Asia is where we're at today. Obviously, it'll remain important throughout throughout our history as a military and has been historically. But, you know, whatever future contingencies come up, I think that the ability to maybe think outside the box and to understand how different cultures think and even just to ask the question if you don't know, you know, maybe our ground truths aren't the same as what we would expect in the United States. Maybe there's different cultural norms here, and to understand that you need to study those things to effectively operate in the theater, I think is extremely valuable.
Beautiful. JD, over to you, and hopefully I didn't get you in trouble with any future detailer.
No, Sal, I'm glad you brought this up. The program is designed for officers between 3 and 11 years of commissioned service. And so the four of us were able to kind of catch that on the front end as kind of junior to mid-grade lieutenant and captain. But there are some officers that get selected as mid to even senior 04, and they need to understand that they're taking a significant risk professionally, particularly the pilots from other services that have very specific flight windows they need to meet. And so I would encourage any naval officer that's considering applying just to reach out to me directly. It's my last name at Gmail. It's KRISTENSON@gmail.com. I can kind of give you what I've been able to gather from my time in the program and then talking to my peers. There are some that have been jammed up just because of the timing, because of how many years it is out of their main pipeline. For me, it's been a year of language training, 2 years in country, and then a year kind of getting back into Dahlgren and Newport and surface warfare officer training, student status. Now, I have 4 years since I've been evaluated competitively against my peers. Now, I'm fortunate that it comes at a time in my career where that's not a priority because I will be going back to a competitive tour as a department head on a destroyer. But it should be something that not only the officers that are considering applying, but officers in positions to advise their subordinates to pursue or at least inquire into the program should be aware of the career timing and the impact it might have on that prospective officer.
Now, Matt, please don't tell me they're sending you to East Coast for your next tour, too.
Yes, sir. They sent me to Pearl Harbor. I've spent my entire career in Asia, went from Japan to Korea to India to Honolulu. Career timing is a little bit easier for a naval intelligence officer than it is for a surface warfare officer or a pilot in that we have some dead time, as it were, in the junior officer years where we have to do a sea duty as an ensign or a JG. I did it covered that whole time. Then you don't have to go back to sea again until you're a senior lieutenant or a junior lieutenant commander. That time in the middle, people have taken war deployments, joint tours, education. I chose, as Lieutenant Commander Weisskopf, Class of 08, put it, the unconventional education of the Olmsted program. I won't say I was encouraged by my detailers, but they were at least understanding and said, you know, pick a strategic language. Fortunately, the Olmsted program did that for me. And do your competitive tour as soon as you get back. So, you know, 3 years almost to the day after I started language school in Monterey, I was, I was handing in my papers here at my check-in papers here at PAC Fleet and reporting to the Ops and Intel Watch, again to be evaluated against all the other lieutenants here. So, I think what I say, I'll echo what everyone else says in that. you definitely can blend this into a traditional career path, as long as you're willing to eat your broccoli when you come home. And again, I for my career choices, I go by the advice that a senior intel officer gave me when I was an ensign, which was do what you enjoy and be excellent at it. And I think the Homestead program is certainly a stepping stone to that.
Liv, I know you haven't gone out necessarily yet, but what is your understanding of how much time you get to spend visiting the country you're in, out being out with the locals, so to speak, and absorbing the culture that way? And you guys, other guys, can join as to how your experience was where you were. I know when I lived overseas, that was really important for me to be able to visit with the people who lived in the country.
Yes, sir. It's a 3-year program. The first year is given to you as a language learning opportunity, and then the next 2 years you have to get your master's degree in a foreign language in a foreign country. For me, I'm going to take 6 months of Vietnamese language training in D.C. I'm actually heading out in the next month, and at that point I'll be flying into Hanoi, and I expect to spend the next 2.5 years interacting with the Vietnamese culture and the people. Did that answer your question, sir?
Well, I think so. I guess I probably need a better explanation of exactly. You're out in the local economy. I mean, how does this work? Obviously, there's no U.S. military base there, but you're out living like a college student would live. Were they from whatever country you're, say, Vietnam, whatever country you're going to be in? And the other guys
yes.
can join in too, please.
Yeah, Eagle One. I think I can answer that. So, if you were stationed in Japan, for example, on one of the forward deployed naval ships out there, you might be out to sea 315 days a year, and you're lucky to catch a little time in for the holidays. And when you do, you want to go down to the market and kind of get to know Japanese culture and that kind of thing. The Homestead experience totally inverts that model, where your primary responsibility is to be out there, learning the language, engaging with the culture, meeting people, traveling broadly. There is a travel stipend associated with the scholarship that encourages you to see both the country and the region. For example, when I came to visit Gary in Taiwan, and he understands the area, the country, he's able to set me up some day trips. Likewise, I went and saw Matt in India, and when I go there, there's a scholar that speaks Hindi that knows the country, knows the culture. We can talk about my experiences in China, his in India. Exchange, our thoughts on the both, and so there's an enormous cross-pollination effect between the other scholars in theater. You go to Korea, you go to Japan, you go to Vietnam, wherever your country is will determine kind of your regional travel as well. For example, the North Africa scholars go to both Europe and Africa, and Turkey goes pretty much anywhere based on on where they're located, but. These scholars, we have scholars in South America. We have scholars in every non-English-speaking country for the most part, including some places that was not previously aware had institutes of higher learning. your job is to engage, and it's really unique in that respect, and they really provide you an unparalleled level of autonomy, freedom, and trust to do that. You fall under the embassy and the charge of fare in order to in order to provide your personal security in terms of your travel and your safety and your coordination. But for the most part, you're out there engaging on a day-to-day basis.
This is Gary. I'd like to talk just a little bit about Taiwan and maybe just a little unique aspect of being in Taiwan. And I'm sure as everyone knows, we do not have official diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So things are a little bit different when you go there. You had mentioned how, there's not necessarily any, U.S. military bases. Some countries there are, like Japan or South Korea, for the scholars who go there, they can kind of fall back on that infrastructure for different things. Obviously, they're encouraged not to kind of, live on the base or anything like that on the program, but those things are available to the scholars in those countries, depending on where they're located in the country in relation to those bases. But in Taiwan, obviously, there's no U.S. military bases, there's no U.S. military facilities, and even in terms of kind of the support that some of the scholars get,
from the U.S. Embassy. Well, there's really no U.S. Embassy in Taiwan either. There's the American Institute in Taiwan, which is the embassy equivalent, but due to the peculiar international status of Taiwan, kind of the State Department is reluctant to provide much service or anything really helping out the scholars there too much either. So really you get the fully autonomous experience there, because even when it comes to like moving and things like that, TMO of your goods and things like that, AIT there in Taiwan, they're really not going to help you out with that. You have to kind of coordinate stuff with your service in the nearest base. So for instance, when I was moving back from Taiwan, I had to do all the coordination myself with the Marine Corps bases in Okinawa and things like that. And, I mean, there wasn't like just a, you know, desk at AIT I could go to and say, hey, you know, here's what I need. It really wasn't that way. So there is kind of a variance, too, in terms of what's available to the scholars. Yep.
Gary, based upon my move to and back from overseas, I think we just described a feature, not a bug. That's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my move back from India was probably my smoothest move ever.
It sounds silly, but it's true. It's true. Matt, did you have anything else about this question before I go into the next one? I didn't want to cut you short.
Well, I'll echo what JD had said about the comparison between having a conventional forward deployed assignment and the Olmsted assignment. In both Japan, where yes, we were underway 200 some odd days a year, and Korea, I felt like, in Korea certainly, I felt like I lived in America, but we had the occasional chance to vacation in Seoul. In both countries, I took night classes to learn the language, to be able to at least attempt to navigate the culture. Didn't always work out for me so well. Someone informed me in Japan when I was, I was trying to be the select guy bargaining in the market, that I had asked the vendor to give me eggs from the subway. Obviously, very different when you get a full year to master the language. You can do a lot more with it. And it's a complete world apart when your primary mission is to understand the country, compared to when your primary mission is to be a division officer, and as a hobby, you like to understand the country.
And Matt,
let me interrupt you, Sal. Let me do a quick follow-up on that. Did you find that the countries you were in, the people were happy with you all trying to learn the language and some of the customs? I've been in places where my feeble attempts to say to speak French were met with complete disdain. How about in the places you were? Did you find they were really helpful?
I could jump back in. I did study in France as well as a university student. I'll be the contrarian again and say that the French were very kind to me. I came over there and with utterly unintelligible French, and left 3 months later fluent, and largely because of the patience of the good people of Lyon, where we've had Olmsted program has had scholars since the 60s. But certainly in Japan, I heard a lot of teeth sucking, a lot of when I attempted something. I think my Japanese was pretty weak, but there they were forbearing. The Koreans were thrilled, and in India, I found I could talk to somebody for 10 minutes in Hindi, and then he would scratch his head and turn to me and say, "But you're speaking in Hindi." So the Indians were sort of dumbfounded.
Yeah. No,
I found
had...
the Chinese.
Go ahead.
Oh. Yeah, I found the Chinese to be very welcoming, and I think Matt hit upon it, where this isn't you go to Mexico during your high school Spanish class and you kind of stumble through donde está el baño. I mean, we're coming from a year of full time DLI, as close to immersion as you can get. Some scholars do immersion in country as well. So by the time we get in country, by and large, we're able to joke, we're able to understand jokes, so we are able to really engage linguistically, which is a huge objective of the program. So you do encounter all sorts of reactions to your ability or sometimes lack thereof to speak the language, but it is at a different level at that point. I mean, you're attending graduate school in that language. So it's quite enjoyable. And in fact, I miss it, day to day, being able to talk and joke in Chinese and that kind of thing.
It's funny that I believe it was Matt. If not, I'm sorry who it was. You know, mentioned about the French. I also had a contrary experience with the French. The French were absolutely great, even though my wife preferred that I not speak it because I can read a pretty good monument French, but my American accent is absolutely horrible. But they were great with me, probably because I just smiled and looked like an idiot. I also enjoyed my German colleagues. I did get fussed at by a German because I punted because my oldest daughter's German was better than mine, and I let her do the communicating, and the German came back at me in very good English and said, "You should learn German better. It's a very important language." I'm not going to argue with the Bavarian. The question I wanted to fold into, and I think we'll go back to JD to start off with, and I think this is a great lead-in to it, because when we go overseas, and even if we do research ahead of time, and I think, Liv, your answer might be a little different. Feel free to customize it when it comes around to you as you deem fit, because you're at the beginning end of it. But we have certain preconceptions of a nation, our culture, or how those people will interact with me. And when we go over there, a lot of times there's a couple of preconceptions we had that were really, really wrong, that were surprising, and there was some happy surprises come out of that. And I'm just interesting, for those that have already done the program, what were the big misconceptions for your host country you had going over there that you were pleasantly surprised at or maybe disappointed with? And likewise, in your interaction with your host nation counterparts, what did you perceive were their misconceptions of what you may be like or what your country was like that you had to educate or bring them around to, and what you found surprising about that? JD?
Well, I do want to follow up one last point on what we were talking about the language before I launch into that. This is one area where, you know, I want to express my thanks and gratitude to the Olmsted Foundation, because they do allow for a spouse language grant as well. And so my wife sat hour for hour with me at DLI, and then also, you know, got some in-country training and tutoring. So that's something that the foundation really values. And I know all of us here are married, and our spouses are part of the program. I mean, they're part of the Olmsted family. And the fact that they felt welcome that way really has made a big impact on our experiences and their lives as well. I mean, my wife now is doing some work with the Navy War College and the China Maritime Studies Institute. And so I guess that's one aspect of the experience that shouldn't be ignored, is if I had to go into China and, you know, kind of serve as a translator for my wife every time we wanted to order out, I mean, that would be a completely different experience than the two of us going in country together and being able to engage together. So that's very significant. Now, as far as our preconceived notions,
let me interrupt you a second. That's terrific. That's most of us didn't know about that part of the program, and that's great.
Yeah. Again, that's due to the generosity of the Olmsted Foundation. So we're all thankful for that. It's difficult now to identify preconceived notions because we've been engaging with the culture for 3 or 4 years, even since leaving the country, you know, reading and that kind of thing. And so it's kind of difficult to remember what we initially thought. I will say the Chinese people had a difficult time understanding how I wasn't an American spy. You know, so your country has sent you here, you know, and is paying you to go to school, you know, and so I had the same conversation with taxi drivers, you know, countless times about scholarship, the foundation, you know, how they really can never quite understand the vision of the program and why I was in their country. I don't know if the other scholars have experienced that or not.
Matt?
Well, I'll start off by saying I actually was an American spy in India, but I wasn't there to spy. That was my first instruction from the defense attaché, was stay out of trouble and don't spy. But to get back to the question of what the Indians thought of what I was doing there, obviously I was asked it all the time. You know, there's a little bit of a Raj era holdover in India where, you know, you come in as an Anglo-looking gentleman, especially wearing a big Panama hat, collared shirt, slacks. They were utterly baffled as to why I would enroll in an Indian university. But I told them it was because I wanted to study Indian history, and India was the best place to do that. Did they have misconceptions about America? Absolutely. In class, I was usually the token imperialist. got to remind them that, yes, you know, we too were a country founded on democratic principles, and just sometimes I was even able to call Indian students up short on principles of democracy when, you know, dealing with caste issues, for example. This is to say I may have occasionally and strategically crossed the line by creating controversy. Generally, what I learned over there and what changed me almost more than anything in the program was learning how to get along with, to talk with, to really engage with people that I might profoundly disagree with. It was that was a very eye-opening part of the experience. To go back to the question about misconceptions that I focus here on India's misconceptions about America, which are many. Though the Indian people, by and large, I found were hugely supportive of America. The day that Osama bin Laden was killed, people came up and shook my hand on the street as if I'd done it myself. Hugely supportive of our country. At any rate, to get back to the question about our misconceptions about India, you could write a book about it. Certainly a very misunderstood country. What I heard countless horror stories as I was getting my family ready. My wife, too, went through the language school, achieved in some ways, a better level of proficiency than I did. People would ask her, would ask me, if we came back to live in India because of her parents. In other words, they thought I was there because I married an Indian. But the question of American misconceptions, we heard so many horror stories about dirt, pollution, disease, poverty, rabid street dogs, murderous traffic, beastly heat. What I tended to find is that the facts behind these misconceptions were often true. I was bitten by a rabid street dog. The traffic is atrocious. If you like 120-degree weather, I really recommend summering in Delhi. The fact may have been true, but it was never as bad as it sounded. It was the interpretation was where all the difference was. And you discover that people have learned to live with these things, and not only that, but traffic is, in a sense, an Indian way of interfacing. You have, you know, every intersection is a negotiation, just like dealing with the bureaucracy, with the government, or buying something in a market. It's a culture that is based perhaps less on fixed rules than on negotiation and compromise. To generalize it, but apologize for the long-winded answer.
Gary.
Yes, I would have to say I did have some misconceptions about Taiwan before heading over there. Obviously, like I said, I didn't have the full knowledge of even where Kaohsiung was at when I found out I was going there, so it kind of explains the level of familiarity I had with Taiwan before heading over there, but what I discovered once I got over there, you know, a lot of people kind of have this mentality, I guess, that, you know, what's the deal with Taiwan? Why don't they just realize that they should just, you know, reunite with China and get it over with, type thing. And you know, going over there and actually seeing the vibrancy of their press, their free elections they have, for instance. I mean, they just had a really big presidential and legislative election in January of this year, to see these things firsthand going on and the free demonstrations they had and you see like Falun Gong protesters out on the street there, which, you know, obviously in China you wouldn't see that, they'd be cracked down on. To see these things and really, what's that, Katie?
Well, you wouldn't see it for long.
Yeah, exactly. Not for long, but yeah, to go there and see this stuff firsthand really kind of opened my eyes to, you know, Taiwan has value in and of itself. It's not something that we should just say, you know, this is a bargaining chip with Beijing and let's see what we can trade off by, you know, abandoning Taiwan. And these are things that would come up sometimes in my graduate school classes there. And
being the token American there, and they all knew I was a military officer, you know, when these questions come up, everyone turns and looks at me, and, you know, then it's my turn to explain U.S. policy or something, you know, as if I had created it. And, you know, I try and do my best to explain these things to them, you know, from a U.S. perspective. But, you know, even being there trying to do that, I don't know how effective I was. But so really, I mean, they had some misperceptions about me. Like, they thought that I must be a really senior American officer to have this opportunity to come and study in their country for 2 years. And they just thought I was like a colonel or something. But, you know, I'd explain, no, I'm actually, you know, a junior officer in the Marine Corps, and, you know, I'm just here to learn about your country and your people, your culture, you know, use as much Chinese language as I can. They really were impressed that the U.S. military has programs like that to allow their officers to do that. And so I guess that's just some of the things that I took away from going over there and living in Taiwan.
Yeah, you brought up a good point there, Gary. That's one of the great strengths, I think, and one that we need to accentuate more is giving a lot of responsibility and a lot of opportunity to our junior officers. I'm a big fan of the 25 to 35-year-old brain. I think you get a lot of really good perspectives and fresh ideas from that. And I think the Olmstead program just nails the 25 to 35 age bracket to be able to put some people in some positions that might open up the view of a different facet or two of looking at some of our friends and neighbors around the world. And, Liv, like I said at the opening to my question, because you're just now starting the program, maybe your answer will be a little different, or you can customize it based upon something one of the other people said. But over to you, Liv.
Sure. Thanks, sir. I am fortunate enough to be stationed in 7th Fleet right now, and my husband and I have both had the opportunity to visit Vietnam. Honestly, before we ever visited the country, the only thing I really knew about the location was, you know, the little bit that I'd learned about the Vietnam War. When my husband and I went to Ho Chi Minh City, it was the first place I ever went in Vietnam. I really expected a lot of negative, you know, sentiment towards Americans, and I've got to be honest, the people were just incredibly open, friendly. Couldn't have had a more pleasant experience. In fact, we ended up going back. We went there in November to vacation, and then spent New Year's in Ho Chi Minh City, or Saigon, as they refer to it, which was just fantastic. Obviously, their museums and some of the war memorials had a different slant than we learn in school, but that's to be expected, I think, of any country that you go to war with. I'm incredibly excited about going and finding out, you know, how many more misconceptions maybe there are out there, or, you know, just learning the culture and the people. And I think that it's going to be extremely unique, specifically since I'm studying in the north. And I mean, 73 was when we signed the ceasefire agreement with the Vietnamese. So you have a very senior population that's very aware of the war that, you know, that they lived. So as far as encountering, you know, the perception that maybe you're a spy, I'm sure that will happen. The little bit of exposure I've had already with the Vietnam National University, which is where I plan to study, has been positive. The people have been extremely open and you know, actually very excited about having an American come out, because there aren't many people that speak English well in Vietnam that I've encountered. And again, maybe that'll be a misconception, you know, that I realize is not based in reality. But when I went to the university, the first person that I found that spoke English was actually the dean of the school, which was a little challenging to navigate around because I don't speak any Vietnamese at this point. That they recognize that having an American come out, you know, since the international business language is English, is, you know, strategically important for them, and we'll see how that's utilized when I get there.
Eagle One?
Yes.
Well, I probably have 1,000 questions I could ask, but we're running out of time, and let me throw out on the floor for all of you what was the best. And Liv, you may not be able to answer this yet, but I know you're looking forward to the process. What was the best part of the program? The thing you look back on and you say, boy, that made it all worthwhile. And we can start with Gary, if you want.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think that probably the best thing about the program is number one, something JD already kind of talked about, is that, you know, if you're married and you have kids and whatever, they go with you and they get to be part of the program. It's not something that, you know, you have to leave them behind to do it. You know, the Olmsted Foundation, as JD mentioned, fully embraces that. They provide funds for the spouse to do language training. My kids, actually one of my sons was born in Taiwan. The other, my other son went to school there. You know, he's kindergarten age. So I think that, you know, when he grows up, probably the first thing he's going to remember, his first memory, is probably going to be something from Taiwan, which I really find that to be amazing. And he picked up, you know, a fair amount of Mandarin Chinese over there just by, you know, osmosis, by going to class over there, kindergarten, things like that. So I think the long-term impact we'll have on my family is probably the greatest thing. And then kind of as a corollary to that is the fact that, and JD already talked about this, but the foundation provides that travel stipend. And, you know, so then you have a chance to travel, you know, widely, not only in your country, Taiwan, but for instance, for us, I mean, we didn't do as much travel as a lot of folks, but I was able to take my family on a trip to Japan, South Korea. We went to China. I went to Thailand, Singapore. So just to be able to expose your whole family to this whole process and program is really just a fantastic thing. And I think it can't be beat or even equal to any other program that's out there.
JD?
Well, I would agree. I just feel so privileged to have been a part of the Olmsted family and to continue to be associated with the foundation and not only the group we have here today, but just the breadth of talent of my peers and the other officers that have been selected over the years really is humbling. I feel like an important part of the program maybe is accomplished at any mid-career kind of break for graduate education, but you know, being able to read about things in The Economist and then, you know, see them play out on the streets of China, it was an enormous advantage to be able to take some time away from the operational fleet, to think about the Navy's role in the world, think about the United States and China relations, to further my education in both an academic and a practical way, I think is really the advantage of the program, because the FAOs that Gary mentioned earlier met a lot of great Marine Corps officers that were passed through the country for their language immersion, but they're only there a year, and by the time they move and get oriented and take some trips and do some language studies, it's time for them to move on. You know, the real strength of the program, and I think you really don't find it anywhere else in the officer education realm, is just the 2 years in country to really develop relationships from one school year to the next, to engage with the culture, I have friends in China, both in the U.S. expat community and you know, friends I met through the university that will be part of my life forever. And so I'm eternally grateful to the Olmsted Foundation for that.
Liv?
Absolutely. I've been in, I obviously haven't done the program yet. I'm just embarking on the experience, but I'm incredibly grateful to the Olmsted Foundation and the Olmsted family for all of their support and for giving me the opportunity to spend this time in Vietnam to both enhance my, you know, perspectives on the world and as a current naval officer. I've been in the Navy for 10 and a half years at this point, and between my husband and I, he's also prior Navy, we've both worked 50 to 60-hour work week jobs for our entire time in the Navy. So for me, one of the really valuable things that I see is, you know, having the opportunity to improve myself as an officer while getting to spend that time and enjoy that experience with my husband and to really, you know, cement our relationship as a family, which I think is kind of poo-pooed sometimes. You know, you're expected to, it's always career first and you're working, you know, 60-hour work weeks. And I don't think people recognize the advantage of, you know, just really having that solid home life and, you know, to be able to do something positive like the Olmsted Scholarship and to have that experience overseas, you know, which will enhance me as a naval officer, and to be able to do that with my husband, I think is just invaluable and is an opportunity that is unsurpassed.
Yeah, I think you're going to have lots of total quality family time there, and that is, and it's something that's interesting. I didn't think about it coming into the program, but I think everybody here has mentioned it. And if there were some other junior officers over there who were thinking about it, you know, depending upon who your spouse is, obviously it is a unique opportunity for the entire family unit. And I think, you know, Liv, you might have a little fun if anybody asks if you're a spy. Just kind of look at him and go, no, I'm a cover for my husband. He's the spy. We'll try to figure him out. In that culture, that'll be very interesting there. And Matt, we hadn't forgot about you. We're going to let you wind it up there, Matt.
Oh, wow. Well, I would certainly echo what everyone else has said. A big thanks to the Olmsted Foundation, the Olmsted family. The program changed my life, my family's life. Like Gary, we brought an extra member back home. My youngest daughter was born in New Delhi. The university was very welcoming. We were able to help lay the groundwork for another scholar to come and study history there. They welcomed him with open arms too, without the slightest accusation of spying. The Indian military officers I was able to interact with over there were also incredibly welcoming. Retired captains, admirals, and commodores even invited me into their homes to talk about their careers. In a way that they hadn't, you know, with much more frankness than they had even written their own memoirs. I think something that sort of summed up what the Olmsted program tries to do and what I feel very privileged to have been able to be a part of was I was sitting in staff talks between our Navy and the Indian Navy and a retired admiral, former Indian CNO, looked at me and said, to our admiral who was present, if you're sending a junior officer, if you're giving up a junior officer like this for 3 years to study India, then you're taking the bilateral relationship seriously. I felt, again, incredibly proud and feel fortunate to have been a part of that.
Well, I'll tell you what, Matt, you just put a good bold-faced underline under the program, and I think, you know, everybody likes to talk in the planning world about second and third order effects, but you send second and third order messages to people around the world when you do exactly that. And I'll tell you what, like just to echo what Eagle One said, I've got another half page of one-line questions I'd love to ask. Liv, JD, Matt, and Gary, really appreciate you taking the time to give us a call from all the way over in the Singapore for our good Lieutenant Liv, and to make the effort to come on to talk not only about the Olmsted program, but also to give everybody a little bit of insight on what our junior officers aren't doing when they're either on the ground or floating around in the sea and in the air. I wish everybody the best going forward for your careers, and I hope you keep in touch. If you got something happening in your career or with your sailors or Marines, you think they might want a little bit of a little publicity about the good work they do, you can always reach out to me. Thank you very much, lady and gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I greatly enjoyed talking to
you. Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, it was a pleasure.
And I know that everybody who is with us live, we'll just have to catch this end on the archive. So those that are with us archive, really appreciate you joining us this week. Come back again next week where our guest for the full hour will be defense journalist Chris Cavas. And I hope everybody has a great Navy and, for our friend Mr. Gary, Marine Corps Day. Thank you very much.
All right.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O'Neill, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.